So I want to carry on exploring how we work with our minds, work with consciousness. For those of you here last week, what I was saying last week was that one of the things that somehow gets in the way of experiencing our full potential, the full potential of mind, of consciousness, and I'm using the words interchangeably, is our own views about the nature of what's going on. And I was particularly challenging this view of scientific materialism, which says that matter is all there is, matter is the real reality, and that our minds are somehow just a function of neurons firing in the brain. What I was suggesting is the Buddhist perspective, which is the other way round. It says that mind is the fundamental reality, and that actually this world that we experience as so solid, as material, all of that is happening out of mind. It's the secondary thing. It's what emerges in consciousness. That's hard to sort of get your head around. It's sort of seems to go against our ordinary sense perceptions, because when we look or touch or hear or whatever it is, the world seems so real and solid. But if you look at what I was doing last week, and I'm not going to recap too much, is if you really look at the nature of what's happening through the five senses, if you look at the nature of perception, and you just have to sort of think about it a little bit, you realise that everything that comes through the five senses is being mediated through the mind. That we don't actually know what's out there. What's happening is an interpretation through the mind. And you could say that there is some sort of world out there, but we don't really know what it's like. What we've got is our sense impressions of what's happening. It's almost like we've got a world of appearances, and we don't actually know what's behind the appearances. Not really, yeah? That's what I was challenging you to think about. And actually, Buddhism says that there might not be anything behind the world of appearances. Even to assume that there is something real out there, objective out there, is an assumption. And Buddhism doesn't make that assumption. One of the analogies it uses is that when you're dreaming, your dream, the world that you're in the dream, seems very real. Seems very, very real. It's like there's a real you and a real monster chasing you in the woods. Yeah, and that all feels very, very real until you wake up, and then none of it's actually there. And there's an analogy. It's not the same. But there's an analogy that Buddhism uses with our waking life. It says that actually, this isn't what we think it is. It's like almost we're in a collective dream, albeit a shared one. And something is going on, there is something happening, but it's not what we think it is. Now the reason I'm saying all this is not to give you complete definite answers. Buddhism's not so good at giving you definite answers about what's going on. What it does do is undermine our common sense assumptions that we think we know what's going on. And the primary assumption that we're trying to undermine is that there's a real me and a real world out there, a real objective world out there, and a real me in here having that experience of the objective world out there. And it's that assumption that I was talking about as limiting it's one of the fundamental limitations for us experiencing our full potential. It's what keeps us cramped in a small world. It's what keeps us dreaming, when actually to wake up would be freedom, it would be bliss, it would be unbounded energy. It would be love, and it would be a clarity of seeing things as they really are. Buddhism says all of that is in our potential. We keep ourselves small, and then we suffer. And one of the fundamental things that keeps ourselves small is thinking there's a real me and a real world out there. So that's a little bit of a recap. Today I want to move on to say that in meditation, one of the things that stops us going deeper is just distracted thought. That's probably familiar to all of you, isn't it? That your mind goes wandering. Yeah. And normally what happens is you have a thought, and the first thought might feel sort of fairly innocent, but then that leads to another thought, to another thought, to another thought, and there's this proliferation of a whole chain of thoughts or chains of thought. Does that feel familiar? Yeah. The interesting thing is, if you examine any thought chain and look at what's happening, it is always self-referential. Yeah? There's always a me, a sense of me, a sense of I, somewhere involved. It's always somehow, directly or indirectly, to do with me. It's always self-referential. Any thought chain. So that's quite a sobering thought in itself, isn't it? Yeah? There's somewhere, it's not perhaps always directly, but somewhere in there, there's this sense of me. And if that's true, then you can start to see that all those thought chains shore up, reinforce this fundamental delusion and assumption that there's a real me. Yeah? All the time, all our thoughts are going, me, 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 me. Yeah? You know how little kids do it, little toddlers, when they start to speak? They are very self-referential, aren't they? Most of the time. I mean, I don't have kids, so Sukha Siddhi might correct me. But most of the time, it's very obvious and rather sweet and endearing, perhaps, in kids, because they can't hide it yet. Their self-centeredness is very... I'm looking for confirmation. their self-centeredness is very evident. Us grown-ups are more sophisticated at hiding our self-centeredness. But pretty much all the time, most of the time anyway, pretty much all of us see the world with me at the centre. You at the centre of yours. Yeah? It's as if the whole of this vast cosmos, which, for all we know, is infinite, there is perhaps infinite space out there, but our perspective is that I'm at the centre of it. And it's all revolving around me. And the most important thing is whether I have a good day or not. And you think, oh, you know, is that what all the galaxies were about? Is that what they're trying to do? Make sure that I have a good day? Does it really revolve around me so much? It's ludicrous. So that is what keeps us small. That is what keeps our consciousness, or it's one of the contributing factors for keeping our consciousness limited. Yeah? There's something about consciousness that doesn't want to be limited. It's like when we do this to ourselves, we're in some sort of self-imposed prison. We're confining ourselves in some sort of self-imposed prison of the mind. It doesn't feel good when that happens. The more contracted we are, the more pain we cause ourselves. And the fundamental way that this contraction happens is our self-referential stuff. Yeah. So I want to just give you a few tips in meditation about how to work with distracted thought chains. Yeah. The Sanskrit word for what I'm going to talk about is prapancha. Prapancha. So that's P-R-A-P-A-N-C-A. Prapancha. And prapancha is sometimes translated as mental proliferation, or sometimes it's unaware associative thinking. unaware associative thinking. Because there's nothing wrong with thinking that's aware. Yeah? That is a bit different. If you're thinking deliberately about what I'm talking to you about, or I don't know, the state of the world, or whatever you're thinking about, if you're studying something, if you're thinking in a deliberate, aware way, that's all good. Yeah, and that needn't be self-referential. That could be really quite useful and adult and, you know, helpful. It's the unaware associative thinking that I'm talking about as prapancha. And that's what I mean, always has some sort of self-reference to it. Yeah, when it's unaware associative thinking. It's not very conscious. Your mind is just doing it. And suddenly you know that you've lost count. Or you've counted to 99. You're about to count to 100. And you think, oh, I'm all over the place. Yeah, it's that sort of distracted thinking that is prapancha. And it's that we need to have some strategies for dealing with. Until we can deal with prapancha, the mind isn't going to become quiet, and deeper levels of self-referential stuff, we're not going to have much hope of tackling. Because actually this self-reference that I'm talking about, this sense that I'm the centre of the universe, goes very, very deep. It's not just at the level of prapancha. It's not just at the level of that unaware associative thinking. It's instinctive. It's like in the marrow of our bones. It's that gut level. And ultimately, we're trying to undermine that fundamental instinct. But to get there, we're going to have to quieten the mind. And all this prapancha stuff keeps the mind agitated, and then we don't have much chance to look at these deeper assumptions. Okay? So I just want to give you a few tips about prapancha. Before I give you any tips, see if you've got any tips. Have you got any tips as to what do you do when you notice, oh yes, I've got lost in meditation with thoughts, with distracted thoughts? What do you do? What do you think that helps you? Come back to the body. That's a really good one. A really, really good one. So can you say a bit more about how you do that? I mean, more detailedly, how do you do that?
Just try to feel the sensations you're feeling.
Yeah. Feel the physical sensations, yeah. And you were sort of pointing to your feet, weren't you? And
Feet tense. Yeah. Stronger.
Yeah. I find it quite helpful to come back to my feet, my legs, well, particularly my belly, the lower half of my body. There's a sense that if you come back to the sensations in the lower half of your body, well, sort of any sensations, but particularly the lower half of your body, your seat on the ground, on the cushion or the chair, the belly, the legs, it grounds you. It grounds the energy. So before, when we were doing Qigong, I was talking about energy in the body. Energy is energy is really vital for meditation, but when we're lost in prapancha, it tends to feel like the energy is all up in our heads, yeah, and it's fizzy energy. Whereas what we're trying to do is take that energy into the stillness of our body. The body is relatively still if you're sitting still. And just connecting with the sensations in the belly and the legs, etc., really helps you. So you can use the breath to do this. See if you can really feel the breath in the belly, but also, well, I don't know if you can feel this sometimes, but the Qigong might help you. When you breathe, if you're quite still, it's almost like you can feel subtle energy movements in the whole of the body that can even be in the legs and the feet. It's not literally the air's flowing down there, but every time the breath moves, there's energy movement in the body. So it grounds you, and grounding you is a really good way of sort of coming back and stopping this distracted thinking. Yeah. Any others? Any other ways? I mean, that's a really good way. So in a way, I keep coming back to that, but there are others.
Being aware of sounds.
Yeah, being aware of sounds. That's a really good one, actually. That wasn't going to be on my list, but I find it quite helpful when you're settling down, before you meditate, or before you enter into the practice, to start off just listening. Listening to any sounds you can hear. And you listen in a sort of open way, without the mental commentary. You see if you can let go of the mental commentary. So that it just becomes sensation, sound sensation.
Or atmospheric.
Or atmospheric, yeah. Tune into that. And if you can do that without thinking, oh, that's a siren, oh, I wonder what's happening, oh, this is such a horrible city or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Without all the mental associations. If you can just let it be sound, then sound can actually take you deeper. It doesn't have to distract you. It can be somehow... Well, when I can become more concentrated and sound happens, rather than distracting me, it feels thrilling. It feels exhilarating. Like there's a little pebble dropped into this pond and there's ripples, shivers in the entire body as you just have sound. And it doesn't have to be a so-called beautiful sound like birdsong. It could be somebody coughing and it still, you know, still has a positive effect. That's not an encouragement to make more sound for each other. But sound, yeah, listening in that open way without commentary. Mm. So again, what you've done there is use another sense faculty. Like you were saying, come back to the body, which is come back to the touch sense, the felt sense. You're saying use sound. In a way, you can use any sense faculty, but those two, I mean, you've got your eyes closed, so there might be internal images, but you haven't got external things. But those two senses are really good for using in meditation. So another thing you can do, sometimes a prapancha has a strong sort of theme to it. Sometimes it's just quite light, random stuff. But sometimes your mind just keeps going back to the same topic, doesn't it? Like a conversation that you've had, or an argument that you've had, or a thing that you're worried about, or something. So if that keeps happening, it's sometimes called sticky thought. If that keeps happening, then that's a clue that there's emotion associated with the prapancha. Actually, there's always emotion, but this, if it keeps going into the same, if your mind keeps going back to the same thing, my mind was in the meditation, I've noticed, just keeps going back to the same conversation that I had this week, then there's emotion around that. And if you can get beneath the actual thought chain to the emotional experience, then that can help you go deeper in meditation, even if the emotion isn't a very nice one, like anxiety or remorse or something like that. Now, to get to the emotion, the body is the answer again. So what you try and do is you sort of notice, oh yeah, I'm up here with my thoughts. Then you try and let go of the thoughts and feel the body again in the way that I've just been talking about. But then look for some sort of felt sense in the body of the emotion that you're feeling. So for example, if you're feeling anxious, you might notice, what might you notice in the body? How would that manifest in the body? Yeah. Where might you be tense? I mean, it can vary for different people, but...
Chest.
Normally it's somewhere around there, chest and belly. But it could vary for you. So if your thoughts have been kind of anxious thoughts, then there's a clue that probably there's tension somewhere that you're holding in the body associated with that anxiety. So see if you can allow yourself to really go into the felt sensation of that, even though it's not a very pleasant felt sensation. If you're feeling craving, What might that feel like in the body? Yeah, a sort of restlessness. You're not still. You're not still. And you want to kind of fidget. I sometimes have experienced craving. Well, if I'm quiet enough in my mind, it's like a little gnawing wheel, a gnawing sensation in the belly, or like a little wheel going round, or like a sea anemone doing this. Yeah, it's a little sea anemone in my belly going, womp, 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 womp. Me, 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 me. And I'm not even always sure what I want. It's just, its tentacles are sort of looking for something to satisfy it. Yeah? And if you can feel that little sea creature and stay with it, with love, you have to sort of love it and not condemn it for wanting. You have to feel metta for it with all of our felt sensations. If you can stay with it, with kindness, with a sense that it's all right, yeah? Then gradually it can start to just calm down, yeah? If you start to push it away and condemn it, it'll just get more agitated. So you have to feel metta in to deal with emotion in the felt sense. Anger, where won't you feel anger? Yeah, throat, yeah, or chest. So again, look, I mean, different people will feel these emotions in different places, but it's really good training to start to find the emotions in the body. They're always there in the body. Yeah.
Oh, just a very practical question. So if you're doing something like the mindfulness, like breathing and the counting, do you stop the counting and deal with that emotion and you start again?
Either's fine.
Right.
Either's fine. Yeah. Don't worry about stopping the counting if you want to.
Right. Yeah. What do you do if you can't feel it? You know it's there, but well, you can't feel it.
Well, often that's the case, because if we're not quiet enough, as it were, then it's hard to feel these subtle sensations. So then what I do is I just assume that it's here somewhere and take my awareness to the belly and the chest. You can't go too far wrong. Most of our emotions are somewhere in this region. So I might not be able to feel very much, but take my awareness there and let my awareness rest there with metta. Yeah? And with a sort of listening attitude. Not this listening attitude is really good. It's not just for external sound, but listen to yourself.
What ends up happening more when I'm in that sort of situation is that I try and focus on the feeling of it, and then I end up psycho-analysing situation.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, I've been here for 10 minutes now.
Yeah. 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 And sometimes, outside of meditation, that sort of self-reflection might be useful.
Yeah.
Yeah? We might learn something about stuff. But in meditation, we're trying to do something else. And even if it looks like you're having insightful reflections, forget them. Or park them, yeah, and come back to them outside of meditation. In meditation, such thinking is sort of useless. To the project of meditation, it's useless. Outside of meditation, it might be useful to look at, why am I doing this? Yeah. Yeah, remembering is hard. Remembering is hard. So probably you're going to forget. Just assume that you will forget. But then when you realise that you're distracted, use that as a cue to remind yourself. When you realise that you're distracted, that is you being more aware. Yeah? So you can sort of congratulate yourself that, oh, I'm now aware. And then use that as a cue to go into the body. Yeah? Yeah, I'll take one more and then I want to move on. Yeah.
What about when it's the other way around, that you have a felt sensation?
Yes.
You kind of quite sort the emotion attached to it?
That's all right. I don't think you need to identify the emotion. And often our emotions aren't so easily labelled. I've just given you very crude examples like, oh, it's anxiety or anger or craving or whatever. But often our emotions are much more mixed than that and subtle than that. And also they come in layers. So, for example, if I've got... I might be feeling. So, yeah, I might be feeling... Say I'm feeling angry with somebody. Yeah? So there might be some sort of sensations in the body. If I stay with them with enough kindness and that sort of goes, actually underneath that, there might be hurt. And rather than feel the hurt, I've gone into anger. Then there's hurt. And underneath the hurt, there might be something that's just actually very sensitive and a bit tightly closed. Yeah? If I can stay with that sensation and open to that, then actually it might turn into something like metta and love, that open-heartedness. So do you see, there are strata to our emotions, but also our emotions don't come neatly packaged, like with a label on. So sometimes you can feel something and you know it's something going on, you just don't know what it is. That's all right, stay with it. You don't have to label it, you don't have to know. It's more important that you feel it, yeah, but with kindness. And what you can do is sometimes you can, I think it's quite helpful to sometimes use questioning and drop in a little question that says, what is this? Yeah. It doesn't even have to be a verbal question. It can be a non-verbal little shrug. Do you know what I mean? So that it doesn't disturb you too much. A little curiosity, kindly curiosity. Another thing, though, to deal with emotion, sometimes the emotions are so strong and they're negative emotions that keep us from going deeper. So I'm not talking about positive emotions like metta. I'm talking about emotions that prevent us from going deeper. Sometimes they're so strong that they need a little bit more active counteraction than just staying with them in the body. So, I don't know, if you're in a state of hatred, then staying with it in the body might not be enough. And what you have to then do is see if you can cultivate the actual opposite of that emotion. Actively cultivate metta, for example. Or if you're in a state of restlessness, then actively look for bits of your experience, probably your physical experience, where you're sitting still and there's stillness. And then just maybe even drop in the word stillness and encourage the opposite quality. Contentment, if it's craving.
What about fear?
Fear's an interesting one, isn't it? So with fear, it's probably a real kind of tension here and a fluttering and a really... So then there's something about... I think there's something about sort of breathing with it and trying to stay with it with kindness, just one breath at a time, and a certain sense that it's all right. I mean, say to yourself, it's all right, I'm still here, it's all right, it's all right. Sort of reassure yourself. Try reassurance that it's all right. Yeah? And the next breath is all right. And then it's all right. And then see if you can gradually sort of build up a... You might not sort of be able to get rid of the fear, but a sense of being able to stay with it, in a sense that it's all right. Cultivating calm. The breath really helps, actually.
That's something to be very gentle with it. When I started meditating, without any guidance, I sort of felt sensations and I went and poked it very hard.
Ah, yes.
And it really hurt.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, gentle. Gentleness and sensitivity and kindness. They're such important qualities and so easy to forget. Gentleness, sensitivity, kindness, patience. Yeah. Don't assume that everything's going to somehow turn. If you're in a painful situation, don't assume that, oh, it should just disappear. Be patient. Yeah, thank you for that. Okay, one or two more that I want to. Going back to Prapancha. One that I think is really useful is finding your heart, finding a deeper motivation that moves your heart, a motivation to meditate that somehow moves your heart. So Prapancha can sometimes be happening because we're not sufficiently emotionally engaged with the practice. It's like we're doing the mindfulness of breathing, but we're doing it in a rather mechanical way. And we're bored, frankly, so it's more interesting to think about something else than count the breaths. Our heart's not involved, yeah? Our heart's not involved. And sometimes when I'm teaching meditation, I say to people at the start of the practice, think of something that moves you. Think of something that moves you. Think of the preciousness of being alive. Well, I've just been reading about Nepal and the tragedy of those earthquakes and the tragedy of not just those who have died, but, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people who are now destitute or suffering. Somehow when we breathe, we're breathing with all of life. You know, we're sharing this planet, this air, this earth with all of life. If I think in those terms, I feel a little bit more open-hearted, a little bit more soft and less concerned about me. I'm a bit more moved to be alive. And compared to so many millions of people, I live an incredibly fortunate, privileged life. And I can feel grateful for that and moved by the suffering of others. If you breathe with an open heart, you're more likely to be engaged. Do you see what I mean? The mindfulness of breathing, you could call it the heartfulness of breathing. We don't know what life is. This is what I was saying last week. We don't know what's going on at all. And if we could cultivate a sort of humility and a sense of a little bit of wonder and a little bit of poignancy to the sense of being human and alive and the breath, that would move us into more deeper concentration. Yeah? Compared to that, my prapancha is frankly trivial. Much of the time, I don't think we're bad people, we're just trivial, aren't we? And that's, what a shame. We're not sort of, most of us aren't going to do anything particularly horrendously evil, but we are in danger of not doing anything meaningful either, and just frittering this precious human existence away. What a shame. Yeah. So when you breathe, and when you do the mindfulness of breathing, there's an existential thing going on. That's what I'm trying to point to. It's a really important existential quest to look at the mind. And this is a real opportunity to do that while we're alive and well enough to do that. So yeah, move, be moved, find the heart. Another tip, I've got another couple of tips, two or three actually, and then I want to meditate again. So feel the dukkha. What does dukkha mean? Dukkha means unsatisfactoriness. Yeah, feel the dukkha behind the prapancha. If you're in prapancha, there's a certain drivenness to that, and it is unsatisfactory. Yeah, it's even potentially painful, but it's certainly not very fulfilling. So really feel in the body again, and in the heart, this sense that, oh, I'm not completely content, and therefore not completely happy. If we were really happy, we would be completely content. and still, and we'd sit down to meditate and we'd be really concentrated. A happy, Sangharakshita says, one of his aphorisms is something like, a happy mind is a concentrated mind, and a concentrated mind is a happy mind. So prapancha by definition means that we're not completely happy. So feel the unhappiness, the unsatisfactoriness, and that takes you deeper, but with kindness. Sometimes if the prapancha is quite light, i.e. you're not that lost in it, it's just light little thoughts that are a bit fluffy, you can spot them and just label them and say thinking. Thinking would be just a label, yeah? And all you're doing is clocking that that's what you're doing. You could just say thought. And just clocking that you're doing it, if you're not that lost in it, it will stop. It will just fade away. Okay, and one more, which is, it might be useful or it might not. If it's useful, then you'll know, as it were. Which is, with the Qigong and earlier on, I've been talking about subtle energy in the body. And if you happen to feel subtle energy, it can feel very pleasurable, or it can feel like heat, or if you can feel subtle energy in the body and you focus in on it, it'll take you deeper. Particularly look for pleasure. Physical pleasure in the body, little bits of energy release, rapture. It can be rapturous, actually. It can be incredibly pleasurable, but sometimes it's just mild, like the hairs standing up a little bit on the back of your neck or something. So look for pleasure, and that takes you deeper. Okay, so I'm going to leave it there. That's a few tips, or quite a few tips, about working with unaware associative thinking, distracted mind, prapancha. And all of that prapancha is self-referential, and it keeps us on the surface of it, of experience, of life, and it keeps our mind small, and it prevents consciousness from expanding in the way that it could do if we quietened it. So what I'm going to suggest we do is sit for a while. And we're just going to just sit. So I'll ring a bell at the beginning, and I'll ring a bell at the end. I'm not going to give you much instruction. You could use the breath. If you find yourself really distracted, you could count, as you do in one of the stages of the mindfulness of breathing. Or you could just sit, and just sit watching what happens in the body. If you get distracted, use one of these tips to come back to the body. The body could be the basic thing that you work with.